This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Lubbock, Texas. We're here with Mark Edward Harris, but really our story has nothing to do with Lubbock or Texas. It has to do with the world and the life journey of Mark Edward Harris, who calls himself a photographer, but he's really a world adventurer. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Tom. Great to travel with you again. This is not our first trip. We did Lodi together and had some amazing wine, and actually it's fantastic to be in Lodi because they have amazing wine here too. Texas wine is very impressive, and so we can't live by just taking pictures and writing alone. We got to finish the evening off with a nice glass of wine once in a while.
Yeah. What I am most impressed about you and your life journey has to do with overseas adventure, with animal. I call it Journey to Animal Planet. You've immersed deep into that. Let's start with the world of orangutan.
I never thought of myself as an animal nature photographer. I'm kind of like an urban explorer, and so that's why I've ended up, you know, doing books and projects in North Korea, Iran, Iraq. But I was actually in Indianapolis, of all places, which seems like a strange place to start a journey with orangutans. But at the International Orangutan Center there, they had a fantastic display. And I just did some photos very different than other people that are photographed there. By using a flash from the side, I was able to take almost what really looked like a portrait against a black background. But in reality, by overpowering the light, I dropped everything else out. And I was so amazed by the orangutans. First of all, curiosity about what I was shooting. And then, I know this sounds hard to believe, but one gestured for me to turn the camera around so they could see themselves on my LCD screen. So I don't know if this project ever would have really gone beyond that if we were not in a digital world, and I couldn't have immediately showed it back to them. But, you know, orangutans are almost 97% the same DNA with humans. But there's a lot more in common than that close. I mean, the chimpanzees are even closer. And so it really started there, where people then reacted to those portraits that I did. Maybe I did three or four that way, and that started the journey with them.
But that wound up bringing you to Borneo, right?
Yes, it did. There were a few stops along the way. I entered a few of the images in a Sony World photography competition, and so that those images were reproduced. Those images, and then actually I'd shot in Singapore as well. And then so I was starting to build a good body of work of orangutan images, but because of the Sony competition, they were in 40, 50 publications around the world, and somebody in Switzerland for the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation saw them and said, would I be willing to do a pro bono thing for them and come to Borneo and try to do portraits of their rescues? And I said, of course, yeah. I would love to. And so that was really something to get to see where they lived in the wild, and then also how they were those that were not in the wild that had been rescued, and a lot of rough stories too about orphans. But that really started for me to start to think, well, this really might be a book of portraits, and then with the backstories. And also, of course, you know, along the way, I was becoming more and more aware of the issues with palm oil plantations and the complexities of those issues.
There's a takeaway. There's a learning curve.
Yeah.
Your interaction, literally eye to eye, with orangutan.
Yes.
Orangutan. How did that change you? What did you learn? What was the most touching?
That's a great question. I had never been with another, a non-human. Well, of course, you know, grew up with dogs and cats, and so I obviously have a close affinity to animals. But for an animal that was so, first of all, they're self-aware. They actually have gift-giving amongst themselves, and I gather with humans in a long enough, relationship that would happen too, and they remember.
An example of a gift would be.
That's an excellent question. They use twigs to, like, get termites out. I don't know if one might hand one to another one to then do to extract some honey or some sap to then use, put it down a hole to stick that. They would expect to get that back later. Oh, or something else. I mean, I can't say that's the exact one. Dr. Rob Shoemaker, who's a primatologist, and he's the one that I got a lot of information from that will be out in my book. He's my guru in a sense. And a gentleman named John Martin from the Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. So much of the information I get is from them and then also my studies. But I have seen in person in Borneo them using twigs to extricate and we all know about, you know, chimpanzees using, you know, tools. I didn't realize orangutans did that. Mm-hmm. So the learning curve for me from, you know, starting this till now has been almost straight up, and it's been a fantastic journey.
And there were interactive gestures of of affection.
Oh yes,
towards you.
Well, I wouldn't say so much toward me, because it's just like in a human relationship, you can start to bond fairly quickly. But the people that were working with them, I mean, there's one shot, I mean, when we were looking at the PDF of the book, of a surrogate mother holding one of the orphaned orangutans, and you see that love, at, you know, and it goes both ways. It's a true bond. There's no doubt about it. And then in Singapore, at the zoo there, the people that are working with the orangutans have a very genuine, real relationship with them. But in Borneo with the orangutans, it's a matter with the babies, it's a matter of life and death. Because orangutans tend to be with their mothers at least 6 years before they start to venture out on their own. They need that. And so if they're orphaned because a mother and a baby orangutan ventured out of the forest into a palm oil plantation and the mother was killed, which unfortunately happens a lot.
Are they shot?
I don't know how they're killed. That's an excellent question. I don't know if they're shot or it's a knife. It's a horrible thing. I mean, there are some people who do eat orangutans, which is illegal. And the government is trying to do something to, you know, combat illegal trade in orangutans. But on the other hand, there's a lot of money coming in to the government at the same time because of these huge palm oil plantations.
So the whole species is at risk.
Oh, they are so threatened in the wild that they could be extinct within a generation. Mm-hmm. Now, a generation for orangutans is actually the longevity for orangutans can be up to 60 years. And it doesn't really differ that much between in captivity and in the wild. Mm-hmm. But if you take away the forest, because they are the largest arboreal animals in the world, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, but their life is up in the trees. And without the forest, they really can't survive. But when they come down to the ground to search for food, is when they can encounter humans if they venture out. And you know who's going to lose in that encounter.
So the decline of their natural habitat is literally at risk right now, and primarily because of the palm oil plantation expansion.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. And palm oil is something we just can't say, you know, good and bad. It's like, you know, as long as people in the West are consuming things, and of course people around the world, it's of course not just the West, but I talked with Sebastião Salgado, who's a fantastic Brazilian photographer, and he was talking about the rainforest. And he was saying, look, you know, if it's going to be a tree versus a human, the way we think down in Brazil, you know, we're going to say the human. And so if you're consuming up in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, so much, you know, and your air conditioning is set to 68 and you live in a gigantic house and drive an SUV, shouldn't be telling us what to do. And so Indonesians can say the same thing. But there's so I always say we got to strike a balance. And that's the key thing. You just can't say, oh, we're going to eliminate palm oil. Because if you go to another oil, some experts say that other oils actually are worse for the earth. You know, in other words, the yield, it takes a lot of, you know, growth. So there's a lot of complications going on.
Yeah.
It's not that simple. It's not like, okay, bad, let's get rid of it. And almost all of us use it without even knowing it. Mm-hmm. So it's in all sorts of cosmetics. It's a binder in all, you know, products, you know, and like chocolates and things. So probably on a daily basis we're encountering it and don't even realize we're doing it. So it's a complicated thing. But the reality is we have to strike a balance, because if not, then the orangutans will cease to exist in the wild. And
back to the central point of this conversation is Mark Harris's new book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Coming out.
Yeah.
So the name of the book when it'll come out and how somebody would find it, et cetera.
Right. So the name of the book is The People of the Forest, because the name orangutan comes from orang hutan, which literally then means people, forest. And so they were recognized very early on as being that close to humans that people actually thought, and he actually thought that some of them spoke, and there's all these myths going along with that. I have not seen one speak yet, but I've definitely seen every other sort of behavior from them.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so your book operates on two levels.
Yep.
One is that the driver in your life is seeing the world through your eyes and sharing that vision through your photography.
Yep.
So it's very much of a photo book.
Definitely.
But it's equally a text in a print book. And what are you communicating in through your print?
Well, in addition to sort of my thoughts as an intro, I really wanted to turn to the experts. And so I interviewed Dr. Rob Shoemaker of the International Orangutan Center for his understanding of orangutan behavior, John Martin of Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation that's on the front lines trying to save them, and then Patty Reagan of the Center for Great Apes in Florida that's done amazing rescues. I mean, there have been orangutans that are, you know, people think they're cute, they buy them as babies, and all of a sudden they grow up and they're, you know, they end up in a garage or a basement for years. These horrible, or they're in carnies, you know, carnivals. This horrendous lives. And so she's rescued so many chimps and orangutans. You know, I'm writing about their experiences, about the orangutans' experience that she's saved, that John Martin has saved through Borneo Orangutan Survival Foundation. Basically, everybody, there's a commonality in terms of everybody says, okay, here's the problem. We can buy land, we can lobby the government, so we have large swaths of contiguous land, and so their populations in any one area don't get so low in Borneo. Because there's only orangutans in two areas of the world, and that's Borneo and Sumatra. And that's it.
Going back in time, was it a greater range?
Yes, yes. And then, but they've been separated. Obviously, Sumatra since the separation of that plate, but they were more expanded out into Southeast Asia. But in recorded time, that has not been the case at all. And so they're saying now there's technically three different species. So you have a Bornean, then you have in Sumatra two. A species, and one might of the Sumatra, it might be almost a subspecies.
Are they distinctive characteristics?
It seems physical? To me, from my basic level, they seem to be more orange, lighter hair color in Sumatra. But what happened is they didn't know at zoos around the world, and so they would let them interbreed, and so most of the older orangutans in captivity are a cross between Borneo and Sumatra. And so now they're actually trying to rectify that and try to let them, they separate them from reproducing as mixed so they could have to do this distinctive ones.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so when's your book come out?
Well, definitely the goal is 2021. That's the plan. It's already been designed. It looks great. Either it's going to come out through Shashin Press, which is my own imprint, and we've done 6 books that way so far. The Way the Japanese Bath just came out a couple of months ago in its 3rd edition.
Let's jump to that for a moment.
Okay. Once again, and you know, Tom, more than anybody just about that, an editor will say a location is not a story. You could never say, hey, I'm going to Japan. I want to do a story. Japan, way too broad. Or I'm going to France or Texas or wherever we happen to be. And so we always sort of look for a hook, and hopefully it's something that we're personally interested in. And so for Japan, it was like Jody Cobb, Nat Geo photographer, did a great job on geisha, but not just a, go to Kyoto and shoot a few geisha. She researched it and went deep into like the Maiko, which are geisha in training and all that.
And you get into the homes. Yeah.
You got it. And so you go deep. And so for me, I discovered by accident almost the whole ritual of the Japanese bath, meaning hot springs. And there's thousands and thousands of hot springs around Japan. They're called onsen, and they're often attached to ryokan, which are Japanese-style inns, where you sleep on a tatami or on a mattress on a tatami. And so I fell in love from a personal thing, just loved taking the bath. And I did some black and white film photos of that did very well, and people responded to them, and they were a surprise to people.
How much does the bath remain a part, integral part of the life of a Japanese person?
Huge.
Really?
Because even in the smallest apartment, it's something they have that I'm jealous of. I mean, they might have a tiny little place, or when you go to a business hotel, you know, you're a salaryman on a business trip, they'll have a soaking tub that will go over your shoulders. And you are expected, if you're with other people, is you do not drain the tub up to, at your own house. First of all, you rinse and you wash off outside of the
tub. Before you get in.
You got it, exactly. Yeah. And then you go into the water, you do a soap, and then you leave it. And I got in big trouble with an ex-girlfriend for not knowing that I drained it, which, you know, because how rude it would be the opposite way. You come to the States and you just leave it for somebody else, you know. Yeah. But no, there, the bath is really meant to cleanse the mind, not the body.
So it's a symbolic purification.
Oh, it is. Uh-huh. And it's very real in terms of this visceral, the feeling of it. And it, almost
what's
every bath is different as
What's the temperature typically?
40 degrees Celsius. We're going to have to I have to do my homework. It's much hotter than people in the hot spring world. It's on the higher end.
So like 105 Fahrenheit.
There's a place called Kusatsu where they say that their water can cure anything but love.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, a broken heart, in effect. That's what the translation would be. And the water's painful. I mean, it's really cruel to get into that. But there's all sorts of different medicinal baths. So in Kusatsu, they believe that if you have skin issues, doing timed bathing in this unbelievably hot water is good for that condition. You know, taking an extended bath in slightly lower water is extremely good for the mind. And then there's some that are heavy in iron. So in the back of the book, I list all the different types of waters. And in order to be an onsen, official onsen, not just osento, you know, where they use water or official hot spring, you have to have a certain amount of mineral content in order for that to be the case.
And that book is very much a visually driven storytelling.
Yes.
Much more so.
Yeah.
Really a photo essay, isn't it?
It's an extended photo essay. Yeah. And so in a classic sense, just like, you know, so one of my photographic heroes, W. Gene Smith, who did Minamata, which of course is, you know, is in Japan as well, about the mercury poisoning in the 1970s in Minamata Bay. So he's sort of my guru when I look to the classic photo essay. And of course he worked for Life magazine. And so in that tradition, I have worked to tell a story through photographs. And so the Japanese bath really tells a story about Japanese people that I think most people don't know. It's very Zen. I mean, that's an easy word to use, but their sense of Zen goes back since the beginning of their nation.
And once again, that book is out in print right
now. That book is now in its third edition.
The Way
of the Japanese Bath. Yeah, the third edition just came out, so probably easiest way, especially these days, everybody's sort of separated, Amazon.
So only because of time constraints, we both have
catch a flight. The reality of travel.
So before we're cut off, North Korea, what a fascinating place. And you've been there more than once.
Ten times.
Yeah, tell us about your affinity for North Korea.
I try to go everywhere with an empty cup. Of course, we all have our prejudices. When you go in, you're photographing certain things. When you write certain things, no matter how open you try to be, but I really do think I have this openness. And because of my bachelor's in history, my master's is a special major combining history and photography and ethnographic film. Anyway, that's my interest. And so North Korea has always fascinated me. And in 1997, I went up to the border and I did a story for the LA Times magazine. But I could look across at the DMZ, you know, at the JSA, you look in, it's evil empire and all that. And so, or the Hermit Kingdom, I should say. But in reality, when you really study the situation, the Hermit Kingdom was applied to all of Korea. And that goes back to the 1800s when they had the Opium Wars in China. The Koreans were looking from a bit of distance, say, we don't want to have anything to do with that. Mm-hmm. And so the whole peninsula became the Hermit Kingdom. But now, of course, at the end of World War II, they expected to get their country back. It had been annexed around 1917, I believe, from Japan.
Yeah.
North Korea is very misunderstood, and they don't do themselves any favors by just releasing footage of everybody, you know, crying and wailing.
Mm-hmm. Talk to us about the people
and their
spirit of the people as they go about their daily life.
They are much more aware of the outside world than we give them credit for. The people, and I have now, you know, from my 10 trips and going all across the country, you know, sometimes with only just one or two other people and an escort, I've really seen, I can say with confidence, you know, the real Korea. People say, oh, if you just show up in, you know, Pyongyang, they escort you around, you know, or maybe go to Kaesong and that's it. But now I've been around and I've seen daily life there. people are just like everywhere else on the planet, you know, just trying to live daily lives. They're mm-hmm. concerned about their kids going to school, you know, what's for dinner. And now, you know, the famine of the 1990s, which was horrific, which sent people across, you know, into China, has subsided, you know, in the 2000s. So you're seeing things that you've never seen before. There's taxis on the street, you know, in spite of the embargoes and all that. Heavy traffic now on the streets of Pyongyang, but outside, it is much poorer once you get to other cities. But you see kids playing, you know, and sometimes, you know, very simply, they have a soccer ball and that's enough, and running around, smiling, laughing, looking curious. It does remind me sort of, you know, when I first went to China in the early 80s.
Yeah, and going to a rural community.
Exactly. Yeah. In other words, right, if you were in Shanghai, that would be a different ballgame, but right. You go to a rural community and everybody would look at you and, mm-hmm. and that. They also get, and this is one of the interesting things, is even though the Soviet Union, now Russia, went its separate direction in terms of communism and support for Korea in a traditional way, they still get Russian TV. So it's amazing that even though Russia, you know, former Soviet Union and North Korea have gone their separate ways politically, they still get Russian TV. They never turned off, you know, the switch. Mm-hmm. And so people are seeing the commercials in Russia, you know, for goods. Yeah, yeah. And also I covered with Pico Iyer the film festival there. Every 2 years they have a huge international film festival. No American films there, mm-hmm. but British films, Chinese films. And so people were literally trying to knock down the doors. I don't mean figuratively, yeah, literally, because yeah. I went to literally. They were so eager to see it mm-hmm. on the screen. A lot of Indian films, Bulgarian films. They are seeing what other people have. So they're not so much in a vacuum.
Yeah. Which a lot of people think.
We think out here in the West.
That the Iron Curtain. Is,
exactly. Yeah. But that's not the case at all. And so, I mean, the question is, do they want to get out of the situation mm-hmm. in terms of, you know, would they like to see
not be
Kim,
so limited.
Yeah, and not, you know, do they really support Kim Jong-un or whatever? That's a question I wouldn't dare ask there.
Well,
and if somebody answered it there in the negative, you know, we know what would happen.
Back to the basic human level. Yeah. I, like you, I first started traveling around China in the late 80s.
Yeah.
But to this day, if you go to a rural village in China,
yeah.
The local people are just fascinated
exactly.
by you.
Yeah.
And they smile
yeah.
and they want to interact
that's
with
right.
you. Were you able to sense that in North Korea?
Oh, more than sense. It was exactly like you, just exact same thing. People want to have human interaction. In fact, in parks, if they were having a picnic, they would insist that we come over and share some food with them or sit mm-hmm. down or dance. And this was not a stage thing.
Right.
You know, sometimes in the West, when people hear that, or I really should say not West, but outside of North Korea, people think, oh, you know, it's been staged, but really, the concept of you go to a place like, you know, Wuhan or some town and we just have come across some people and they happen to be planted there. That they're not the whole world's not revolving around us to do that. I mean, this is genuine interaction, and people appreciate on a human level that we would come and do that. And really, that's the best way. And I think you've referred to this before. You know, the best peace delegates are travelers.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep. Ambassadors.
Ambassadors, that's the word you used.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely true. And so
one more aside about you or myself exploring North Korea.
Yeah.
We don't fly in and get an Uber and go to a hotel.
Yeah.
You are very much either you have to be in an organized group or have a literal escort with you.
Yeah.
So talk about that dynamic.
Right. So for right now, because of COVID, nobody's going in. I mean, they shut the doors really quickly, and nobody really knows what the situation is, you know, in COVID there now. But eventually when that...
But there's a double layer with American visitors.
Oh, yes.
Because of the politics.
Well, and also because Otto Wumberger, who died,
that specific
incident is what actually made it. So the North Koreans didn't say Americans can't come. It was actually the U.S. government mm-hmm. who said you need a special visa permit to go. And so, as a journalist, if possibly could go, but then the North Koreans don't want me in as a journalist. And so, you know, like AP does have an office there. There are some people who mm-hmm. get in. But for our people listening now that are not American citizens, they could go. There's a great company called Corio Tours that does some. There was a company in the U.S. that did one. They might not be in existence anymore. But there's a number of ways to get in still, and I would highly recommend it.
Yeah, and then conversely, same thing with Cuba.
We've gone the wrong way, unfortunately, with them. We're up in there three times, and it was things were really opening up. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, the best way to get everybody to a better place.
Yeah, totally. But the here and now, even though it's been shut down because of America, not because of the Cubans.
That's right.
There still are ways to get.
There are. But I would say the one place where, as an American, it's almost impossible, even if COVID wasn't in existence now, North Korea is going to be pretty much off the map mm-hmm. for the time being, but you never know. And actually, one of the interesting things, not to talk politics too much, but I do like that Trump is interacting with Kim Jong-un because it hasn't worked for 60 years
right. The
other way. Yep. You know, so why not? Now, you could say, well, the reason why we don't have leader-to-leader contact is because there's no higher-up place to go. If it doesn't work out there, it's all over.
Yep.
But if you remember early on, we had people in Hawaii scrambling because they thought there was an incoming missile.
Oh, I remember.
You remember that?
I have friends that lived there. They were freaked.
They were. And just imagine what could have happened, because what happens if somebody here, like in Dr. Strangelove, right?
Mm-hmm.
What do we do? Or what were the Russians going to do? Okay, you're coming our way, so we're going to launch some back. I mean, mm-hmm. if that was seen by somebody in command who didn't really check things out and pushes a button the other way, well, then you really have a real situation. And so, those amazing movies of the early 60s like Dr. Strangelove or Failsafe mm-hmm. were about something like this happening.
Yeah. Only because of time.
Yep.
We have to move on, and we have to move Mark Harris to Iran. Tehran.
Yeah.
You wrote a book about Tehran, about Iran. You spent quite a bit of time there.
Two trips there, about a month altogether in 2007. You have a good friend I know who was over there. And Iran, some of the most hospitable people mm-hmm. on the planet are in Iran. And once again, you know, the average person, first of all, a lot of people like Americans there. Now, you know, Tehran is very different from the rest of the country, and I've been very fortunate on the two trips to travel throughout the country.
Uh-huh.
I had a driver, and we were able to go wherever we wanted to. In fact, I went to the Shatil Arab waterway, and I did have some trouble trying to get out through there. They couldn't fathom what I was doing there. So I was brought in for some questioning, and even that ended well. You know, my heart might have been racing a bit, but I was able to get out at 1 minute to 10, or was it 1 minute to 11, on a boat down the Shatil Arab waterway to Kuwait. That really did feel like that day was not going to end super mm-hmm. well. But it did. But the people are incredibly hospitable, sophisticated, obviously, mm-hmm. you know, their tradition of reading, writing, the arts, you know, is unparalleled just about, you know, in the history of the world, the architecture.
And their warmth and hospitality.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah.
And so, but of course there's real issues now with the mullahs and stuff, but if the majority, and so the danger is, though, when we have reporters just going to Tehran and they report from Tehran and they see the people there are really pushing hard for democracy. But then when you get outside into the countryside, there's a lot of support for the mullahs there. And so, you know,
It's like America.
Yeah.
Similar.
We get out. It's very similar. Yeah. You get into the hinterland.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very different feeling. And so the mistake we made, if we're only reporting about the U.S. from New York, mm-hmm. D.C. or L.A. or San Francisco, we're going to have a very different perspective. Just like, you know, if we're reporting from Tehran. But when we get out in the countryside, then we'll see, okay, there's, you know, a lot of support for something that a city slickers might not think, you know, possible. And that's really the same in many places.
Around the world.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you did a book.
Yeah, the book's called Inside Iran.
And would it be
Chronicle
a mix,
books?
But a mix for a graphic, visual, photo essay?
Right.
But as much written content?
At Chronicle Books, I had a great editor. We mixed our chapter openings, sort of really presented different sections of the, you know, north, south, east, west, and mm-hmm. then a separate chapter on Tehran. Had a map in there, and so the goal was to give people an overview of Iran. And I think we achieved it pretty well. And a famous filmmaker in Iran wrote the introduction, very eloquent one, for the book, Abbas Kiarostami. So once again, there's a lot more daily life freedom there than one would expect. But once again, just like North Korea, you say something about the government and you're going to get in big trouble. Yeah. People in the U.S. and or any other country should keep in mind that freedom of speech is so important, and regardless of which way it's going, whether you like it or not, you got to keep these voices going. And there's, you know, a big concern, you know, in present day America that's being eroded away. And it's very easy when it's eroded away for more and more central control, and it can be very dangerous. And so I have seen it, as you have, around the world, that there are countries that are totalitarian, but in those countries, people are trying to live their daily lives, and they're not always concerned about the geopolitical situation that really doesn't impact their lives on a daily basis.
Yeah. Mark, we're coming up and approaching the 10th anniversary of the tsunami earthquake that affected horribly Japan.
Yeah.
Talk to us about how you're dealing with that.
You know, I love Japan. I'm a big Japanophile or Nihonophile. I've studied Japanese for years, and so, you know, I've covered all the good stuff in a sense, like, you know, the hot springs and ryokans and amazing, you know, walks and nakasendo and tea ceremonies. In fact, my ex-wife is a tea master there, and of course it's fantastic covering positive stories. But I felt that when the tsunami happened, that I wanted to cover that too, that Japan, good or bad or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so I actually was on a shoot in Canada, and my dad left a message saying, turn on the news. And I could not believe what I was seeing, the visuals there of the waves coming in around Sendai and going 6 miles
up
inland.
River.
Oh, it was just beyond belief. And so I had to go to China very quickly for something, and then instead of coming back to the States, I went right to Japan, and I enlisted a friend of mine that I'd worked with he was with the JTB, Japan Travel Bureau, and so we had worked together on, you know, the positive stories and all that. But then at first he said, no, you know, that's, you know, maybe you shouldn't do that because, you know, with his family and the nuclear stuff happening in Fukushima. But then he said, you know what, let's do it. And so he picked me up at the airport. We drove up. We had to do a very circuitous route to get up there because every, you know, roads had big holes in them, all train travel was stopped. And so we got up there, and then we went down the coast. So we started at the top and started making our way down the eastern coast of Tohoku, the northern region of the main island of Honshu. The devastation we saw was beyond belief. They build buildings, homes, so unbelievably well to deal with earthquakes, because 10% of all volcanic activity and earthquakes happen on that part of the Ring of Fire. So they know how to do that. They thought they knew how to deal with tsunamis, you know, and there's seawalls all over the place, that many places simply not high enough to stop these incredible waves. I mean, you had a 9.0 earthquake. It happened offshore at almost the worst possible place, so it could build up the tsunami waves that came in and obliterated towns. And so we went to places like Otsuchi, where there's a photo that a lot of people probably have seen, a boat stranded on top of a building. And so but I always try to, even in, there's standard things I try to do when I shoot. Like, I really think in terms of a photo essay with building blocks. And so having an establishing shot, then environmental portraits, pictures of people in an environment relate to them. And so I was using these same techniques to tell the story there. And so the shot of the boat on top of the building, I climbed up on the tsunami wall so I could crawl over to a good angle to get a better perspective, because everything I had seen, you know, in the news, people were shooting up at it, and then they would go to the next place. And also then there's something else I talk about. It actually, I did a recent book I forgot about how to do photo essays by Focal Press. And so I lay out these same basic things. And so one of the things I talk about is waiting for the extra element. And so there was a boat that was stranded somewhere else, and I thought, well, it would be interesting if somebody were walking through it. But of course, from a photojournalist point, you can't ask somebody, hey, we'll walk through. So I just crawled up on a pile of rubble, and I just sat there and waited till somebody walked through. And this gentleman walking in a suit and tie and with a mask on walk through. Now, I don't know what he was doing out there. Everything was destroyed, but that's so Japanese, right? And it was so impressive. And throughout my journey there, people were so appreciative, appreciate you coming here. We saw some really heartbreaking things, though. We visited, where they were rescuing animals. One of the most impressive things I saw, I didn't see it in person, but I saw it on the news when I was there, is a dog was stuck on a house that had drifted out to sea, way out, and a helicopter, Coast Guard helicopter, saw it and lowered somebody down to try to rescue the dog, but then he went underneath it into a little crawl space, and so they dispatched a Coast Guard cutter that went out and got him, and they tracked down the woman who owned it. And that reunion, if people can track that down, but the devastation was beyond belief. And so my friend, who's 100% Japanese, said to me when we were standing on a bridge, he said, "This is looking out at the endless devastation." He said, "This is what Hiroshima must have looked like." Mm-hmm.
And this was 10 years ago.
Well, the first time I went was 10 years ago, right?
Right.
And so we're coming out. Right, so March 11th, 2021 will be the 10th anniversary.
So have you returned?
Many times.
Okay.
And so what happened is, for Vanity Fair, I pitched the story that I'd like to go back and do something on the five-year anniversary. I had been back a year afterwards, and then I went back again. My actually ex-father-in-law, his grave is in the no-go zone in Fukushima, ironically enough.
Wow.
So I couldn't visit that. I went to a North Korean school, believe it or not, in Fukushima, that is still running. So in other words, I sort of tied in different interests,
sure,
to tell mini stories within a bigger story. And then for Vanity Fair, I did a lot of interviews with, and I really focused more on Otsuchi, which was that town where, like, the mayor at all his team were in a building that seemed way inland. When you see it now, you're thinking, well, how could that possibly get hit by a tsunami? I mean, it was obvious because everything was destroyed around
right.
it, but it was so far inland, it's just unfathomable that the ocean could rise up and come in. And so, I mean, there was an 8-floor apartment complex way in, and the windows and everything were broken out at 5 floors high.
Wow.
Yeah. And
what's it like today?
Well, I'm actually trying to get back before March 11th to do the 10-year anniversary. At 5 years, they were leveling some towns and then filling up those towns. They were taking down, or not completely taking down mountains, but they were going into the interior, getting millions and millions of tons of earth, bringing them back and building up these coastal towns. And so people say, well, why build back where it happened before and where it will happen again? Well, they're trying to make bigger, taller mm-hmm. tsunami walls, but they're also saying, Japan is so heavily dependent, on the fishing industry. This is our livelihood. This is mm-hmm. where we are. And so we still have to be within proximity there, and there's tradition. And so will the new tsunami walls withstand the next one? Because there will be another mm-hmm. one. I can say I hope so.
Mm-hmm. Mark Edward Harris, only again because we both have flights leaving and we're out of town here, I have to say goodbye. But let's definitely do installment number 2. We'll regroup.
I would be honored, Tom, and it won't be adieu. It will be bis spata, I guess we can say. See you later.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Sayonara.
Sayonara. There we go.
We've been speaking with Mark Edward Harris, photographer and ambassador to and for the world. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. And to learn more about you, website,
yeah,
where would you direct them?
So my website is simply my name, markedwardharris.com, and my Instagram is @markedwardharrisphoto.
And I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Lubbock, Texas.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.